This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Hi, everyone. Let's get started. Where we should get started. My name is John Paul Katengo. I'm a former executive at large of the Graduate Students Union and still a member of the Social Justice Committee of the GSU. Thank you for coming today to our G20 anniversary panels. We'll hear a lot about why we're here from the speakers, so I won't bore you with those details. But I'd like to begin by recognizing that we are on the land of the Mississaugas, and that we need to consider that the G20 and the violence that happened last year is not exceptional. It's something that happens in the everyday to a lot of populations. So let's begin with that. Our first panel is Refusing to Forget. We'll hear from our three speakers about their experiences of the G20 in the last year, as well as at present, kind of the ramifications. So why don't we begin with Amalia, who's here with us from the University of Ottawa, and then we'll go with Daniel and then Jess.
Can you maybe use the mic?
Maybe just on the table. It has enough, yeah.
Right, so my name is Amalia Sava. I'm the president at the Student Federation of the University of Ottawa.
I attended the G20 last year. So I woke up after a nap in the makeshift jail cell because a cheese sandwich was thrown at me. I had a friend and fellow organizer having his head bashed in by police, being blocked from exiting the protest to be able to get to a hospital. He ended up with 11 staples in his head, a concussion, and severe blood loss. I saw one of my protest partners getting dragged away by riot cops at Queen's Park for speaking up too loudly. I saw another friend getting beaten from the corner of my eye. These are just some of the experiences that I faced, as well as members from my community. And the fact is that we are all white, and we are all privileged. This type of police and state violence is not new, and it will not get old. The use of excessive violence to undermine the rights of people is used very often and in many different situations. The unusual part is that many people who go about their day without fear of police violence felt these tactics being used during the G20 protests in Toronto last summer for the first time. Many people think that these were solitary incidents and that it doesn't happen every day. This is only because the cameras were finally on the police and therefore the public saw the realities that some communities face on a day-to-day basis. Communities that are not middle or upper class, communities that are not white, communities that are living in poverty, communities that are often racialized. The same kind of violence was used before the G20 and towards people in our cities, and they will continue to use these measures for time to come. The more we let the state get away with this type of action, the more they will use it. On Thursday, a police report came out regarding the actions that were taken during the G20 last year. I think that Chief Bill Blair was apparently watching a completely different protest than I was when he made that report. He said that the police were overwhelmed and underprepared. But against what? My firsthand experiences of the G20 protests were filled with loving protesters that were all caring and watching out for each other. My experience showed that there is no instigation on behalf of the protesters to pick fights with the cops. We were there for a reason, whether that be fighting against high tuition fees, fighting for better pensions, fighting for a more accessible healthcare system, fighting against violence against women and the right to choose, fighting for the environment, fighting for Indigenous rights, or fighting for migrant rights. We were there standing up for what we believe in. The Toronto Police internal report said, and I quote, "In particular, there is an inability to effectively prevent, mitigate, and respond to black bloc tactics employed with the broader theater when mass disorder was taking place." I think this is an example of clear bullshit that is being thrown at us every single day. The right of people to organize, assemble, and protest was taken away that weekend, and the response of the police against the black bloc tactics is just another strategy used by the state to ensure that the people stay divided. In my opinion, the mass disorder that they're mentioning has nothing to do with protesters, but has everything to do with the police state that we saw. This disorder can be in the form of police infiltrators in our organizing, or with their agent provocateur to incite violence against the people. So the grassroots organization that I was involved in leading up to the G20, we saw some extreme forms of violence. One of our brothers in the community was arrested and sent to prison long before the G20 even started, and was charged for being part of the RBC firebombing in Ottawa. He was a big organizer in the Ottawa community, and the police believed that he was a threat to the G20 in Toronto, and therefore put him behind bars for months to ensure that he would not attend the G20 protests. The system that I saw during that time was extremely violent, even if it wasn't physical violence. I wonder whatever happened to the whole, like, innocent until proven guilty thing that our justice system functions by. I didn't see it, and I still don't. We also had police infiltrators in our small affinity group. We found this out just before the G20 had started and long after our organizing had begun. It was extremely angering to know that someone sitting across the table from me while I talked about how we can organize students on our campus was a cop. There were plenty of plainclothes cops at the protest. Sometimes it was obvious, sometimes it wasn't. And when it wasn't obvious, we eventually came to realize it when they took out their batons and started hitting and arresting people. And the report also states that the police did not have the proper equipment to deal with the protesters. To a certain extent, I kind of think they're right. They should have brought placards, signs, bandanas, and especially bubbles, and joined us in the struggle against the international neoliberal agenda. But instead, they brought tear gas, rubber bullets, intimidation tactics, and violence, and used their weapons against the people that they should be protecting. So as I mentioned before, this is definitely not new. It's new to many of us, and it was new to me, as a white woman coming from a middle-income family who can't attend university without getting into debt. I think that this is why the public was shocked at watching their friends, family, neighbors, coworkers getting beaten and arrested over the span of a few days. Most of us don't see that, but some of us see the police violence every single day. The worst part of all this is that they're getting away with it. The governments aren't doing anything. The police obviously aren't doing anything. So we need to continue to organize, to unite, and to push back every single day. On another note, I also kind of want to mention some of the acts of solidarity that I experienced during the G20 last summer. So our affinity group from Ottawa spent a lot of time together before the protests even started. We organized workshops on direct action, as well as logistical planning. We organized things like legal trainings. We got to know each other, and we went to Toronto together. We were all split up into smaller groups or pairs, and part of our preparation was to ensure that we were always looking out for each other, no matter what. This is what I found the most useful, more than bandanas, more than elbow pads or safety kits. The fact that I knew someone had my back and was watching out for me at all times made me feel like everything was going to be okay, even if it wasn't. There's also one point that my protest partner and I were lined up in front of a giant line of riot cops. So the steelworkers were also there. I'd first like to point out the difference in size between my protest partner and I, both very small women, and the steelworkers, who are some very large men. So at that point, the police started to get very violent with the protesters. And at one point, we overheard two steelworkers in front of us saying, "We can't leave them. Just look around you. There's young people everywhere. And as soon as we leave, the cops will start beating them all." That just showed an incredible act of solidarity that those steelworkers showed us, because they used their large white male privilege to kind of step in and help us out. Had they left, I'm sure that we would have gotten beaten. People were already getting hit with batons not too far away, but we weren't, because I think we had some backup. To all those folks who showed solidarity throughout the weekend, whether it was the steelworkers or other protesters or all the people who even showed up for the jail solidarity, I just want to take this opportunity to thank you. I believe that working together shows our opposition that we're stronger. It makes us feel like we're stronger, and it motivates us to continue to fight against our oppressive system. What we have to remember is there are systematic problems entrenched in our society, and we must unite and push back together. We have to continue to build our activist communities, because the struggle will not end if we don't fight back. So thank you for having me today, and thank you all for coming. Much love and solidarity.
The questions and discussions for me, and let's move on to Daniel, who is External Commissioner under the Graduate Students Union.
Okay, so I just wanted to first of all note that Danielle, who's from the Undergraduate Student Union, is not going to be able to make it because she hurt her back. So I was originally just going to talk about the story of this building mostly and the arrest here, but I'll also kind of touch on a bit of the campus closure issues that she was going to talk about too. And so I'll start with that essentially. In the kind of weeks leading up to the G20 summit, we started to hear that the university administration was deciding to close the campus as part of the G20 weekend, the meeting, and so you know, this was something that was of concern to many of us individually, and we got together through our organizations, and actually this ended up really helping to focus on a common cause for a number of our organizations, many of which our members are in the audience here today, both labor and student groups coming together and deciding to defy the closure and keep our spaces open, at least on campus, the spaces that we controlled, to make sure that that there was room for debate and discussion outside of the one sole department at the university that was allowed to stay open was the G20 Information Center, which is essentially the uncritical PR arm at the university, at this university, for the G8 and G20. So it was really disappointing to us that this is the kind of act that a university that says it's committed to asking disturbing questions and academic freedom. And so we took it upon ourselves to try and fulfill that role in the absence of the leadership at the University of Toronto. So we had the closure, and it was at that time that we heard the call out from the Toronto Community Mobilization Network that that there was need for billeting. And in this building, we have a gym, and the gym has been used in previous years to host people to sleep when there's an activist conference or other conferences and things like that. You know, it's not the most comfortable, it's a gym floor, but you know, it's with the accommodation prices the way they are in downtown Toronto, many people wouldn't be able to attend conferences here, many students, many low-income people, if they didn't have access to some kind of alternative accommodation. So this was a tradition here, and so after we talked about it in our student union, we agreed to billet folks, and in the end, we had a couple of buses of people coming from around Montreal area, students, community activists, organized by CLAC in Montreal, brought the bus down, and so when the buses arrived, people started coming in, and we put the word out also on the Canadian Federation of Students listserv, and we had people actually staying here from BC as well, and others had contacted us about staying. We had on the Friday, people started coming in. Late Friday night was when the bus from Montreal came, and as it happened, we were expecting it to be late, but of course, as you can imagine, there's always some kinds of delays. So when the bus arrived, it was probably around 2 a.m. in the morning, and so it was not long before the police arrived, just wondering what was going on. They had been made aware ahead of time. I let them know that we were billeting, that when they came, the campus police were actually pretty cooperative, and negotiated the Toronto police to leave us alone. However, an unmarked van remained in the laneway at that time, which was a pretty clearly surveillance tactic. Intimidation, perhaps, as well. And And yeah, so that was the beginning of the weekend here at the Graduate Student Union. That morning we woke up, gathered people after coffee to go to the student rally, met at Spadina and Bloor with other students from across the city, across the province, and across the country, and participated in the People First March that was organized by Labour and others. And I guess I'll talk a bit about some of my experiences from that point in the protest, just a little bit, and then talk about the raid that happened here. At Queen of Spadina, at the end of the march, there was we were hanging around waiting to see what we should do next, and some of us wanted to rather than go back to the designated free speech zone where the rally was leading people, we wanted to go and have our voices heard closer to the fence. Of course, that was blocked off by the cops at every intersection possible. However, right there at Queen of Spadina, we came up to the police line, and Rhythms of Resistance, the amazing drumming group that was there every single day of that week of the theme days of action, were there. And so we were dancing and chanting and singing, and it was really an incredible, one of those moments of solidarity, especially when, after the cops had had enough of our dancing, they pushed forward with their shield and knocked down a couple of people. People started to scatter. Some people sat down. I sat down. And then when people realized that there were some of us sitting down in front of the cops, they came back, including Danielle, who couldn't be here, as I mentioned. But I really appreciated her and Rhythms of Resistance sticking around and actually helping to defuse the situation, because after the line of riot cops who had stopped us from coming in, behind them pulled in a group of police with tear gas canisters pointed directly down towards us as we were sitting on the ground. And it was at that time that I slowly put my bandana with the vinegar on and goggles, waiting for what I expected was the inevitable blast of tear gas. Thanks to Rhythms of Resistance and Danielle and others for defusing the situation. Eventually, the tear gas cops left, and we celebrated that as a victory, and went on to connect with other activists and protesters further down east. So that was very, there's a number of very bizarre things happening that day. Many of us are very familiar with them, I'm sure. I just wanted to mention one thing that I don't hear too much of, but that I was involved in. There have been a number of mass arrests. Novotel just happened. I had been there but narrowly escaped the kettling that happened there. And then after that, the group of us went down, up actually, Church Street, because of the Saturday Night Fever. We weren't sure if it was still on that night. We're trying to connect with that. And as I was kind of biking away, deciding should I come back to, where everybody was here, in our building, there's another person, Lindsay, who's actually supposed to be on the panel today too, but she couldn't make it due to another commitment. I'm trying to fill in for her. She was here, I felt, okay, I'll just, go around and see what else is up. So suddenly I see a line of bicycle cops, and I was like, oh, okay, I'll follow them, because I figure that'll probably lead me to some action. And indeed, I caught up with a group who were trying to march to rally in solidarity at the jail, at the detention center on Eastern Avenue in the film studio. And so we marched through the street east on Girard towards Parliament, and As we approached Parliament, we could see the cops were blocking off our way, and so then we went south and tried to go to Eastern Avenue there as well. And again, every attempt that we made to get there was blocked. And so this is another example of one of the limitations that were put on people. This is kind of it's not exactly a kettling because we weren't being enclosed to be arrested, but we were being blocked off and having our freedom of movement limited by the police. So, so even though it's nice that they're saying they're not going to kettle anymore, it doesn't mean that many of the police tactics are not going to, that are oppressive and against the, our charter rights, are not going to be continued to be used. We saw that with the sound cannon. They had to have a court order to turn down the volume or whatever. Essentially, we're living in a time when the police are really trying to shut down any kinds of dissent and criminalize those who do. So now moving ahead, I managed to evade arrest long enough that I get back here, and pretty exhausted from the day. Oh, and I also just wanted to mention the strangeness coming up from Queen and Spadina after all the riot cops and everything that happened on the Saturday. I happened to see a bus from Quebec. It's one of those bourgeois buses. It's called bourgeois. It was parked at Dundas and Spadina. And I was like, wow, that's bizarre. And then as I was walking along, I was like, even more bizarre is that everybody's just going about their business, shopping like one block away from Queen and Spadina, as if nothing had been happening that day. And as I got further up Spadina, closer to this building, I looked back and saw smoke billowing up from one of the cars and people continuing their business, and I just thought, this is really fucked up. It was like completely different worlds. So fast forward, sleeping in this building downstairs. There's dozens of us here, kind of worried that something might happen. The night before, we did have to remove somebody for having filmed people in their sleep, an infiltrator. So with all of our groups, and I think on a panel that I spoke at in January, we talked about this infiltration in our groups and how invasive and how hurtful and disturbing that having these kinds of invasions were for us. And like I said, there is the surveillance van that was there. It had left on the Saturday night, so I thought, maybe they realized there's nothing going on here and we're going to be fine. So I slept soundly until I heard the stomping of boots and the yelling, which was cops raiding our building. It was only a few at first. They came in, I woke up and went out and asked them what they were doing here. They said, "Who are you?" I said, "I'm part of the Graduate Student Union. What are you doing here?" And they said, "You gotta go upstairs." So I went up, was led outside by a couple of cops, and told that this guy was in charge, and he was talking to me. He's like, "So what are you doing in here?" And I said, "Well, I'm with the Graduate Student Union, and we've invited some guests to stay with us this weekend. And if you don't have a warrant, would you please leave? Do you have a warrant? Can I see a warrant?" Over and over again, and repeatedly, he came back with excuse after excuse. "Well, there's a pub there," and I said, "Yeah, but we're not in the pub. It's part of our building, but it's locked, and so that's not an issue." So he huddles back up with his buddy, comes back and has another excuse, and I turned that one down too. Eventually, he just says, "Okay, that's it. You're under arrest. Everybody here is under arrest." And I should have mentioned that as I came out, I actually saw the whole building was surrounded by cops. It was confirmed to me that there was over 200 cops here. We had maybe 70 people here, something like that. So this kind of ratio. We saw over and over again the overreaction from the toxic tour on the Wednesday, where there was more cops, I'm sure, than there were of us on that march, to having 20,000 cops here and 10,000 protesters. It was always, it seemed like an attempt to have a 2-to-1 ratio. So it was easy for them to get away with the kind of beatings and abuses that they did, because they were covering their asses and there was more of them than there were of us. So then all these hundreds of cops start storming in here, giant guns, taking people in our pajamas. My arrest was rough, this guy, kind of unidentifiable kind of guy, cop, comes up and takes over from the guy who was originally going to search me, and grabs me and kind of like shoving me around, and I said, turned around and said, look, I'm not resisting, and then he put me in a chokehold and put my head up against the wall, and asked me, what am I saying, and I couldn't speak because his chokehold was so hard, and then as he let go of the chokehold, he stomped on my leg, cut it and bruised it, and my foot. I was just in flip-flops and pajamas, obviously a number of other people had worse treatment than me, but including one fellow who I'll mention again later in court. There was a person who had been, who's an older gentleman, who was apparently being beaten with a baton because he was walking too slowly up the stairs to get out of the building, and other people were also roughed up as they were being arrested here. So, and just to say, like, I've been expecting to be arrested for a while. I've been coming to anti-capitalist globalization protests since the late 90s, and I was in Quebec City for the wall of tear gas that was, and Montebello, and all these places. And so it wasn't too surprising, but the actual conditions in the detention center were the surprise, and really how brutal that was really... was awful. And we were there, those of us who were arrested in this building were initially charged with unlawful assembly. That was changed while we were in the cell to conspiracy. So we were there for 2.5 days, supposedly while they were figuring out whether they could actually charge us with this or not, and so on. But eventually, like, they didn't, even my lawyer couldn't find me, the court guards couldn't find me, they were walking down the hallways, trying, as they did, like, always, just calling out names, because they had no idea where they had put people in this place. And so, when the police say that they were overwhelmed and underprepared, it's kind of, like, I don't understand how it could have been, since they had $1 billion to work with, or a good portion of $1 billion, and as I said, I've been attending these kind of protests, and we've seen the kinds of things that happen, how they could be so stupid and so disorganized is beyond me, but they clearly wanted to fill up the film studio. Like, they had built all these cages. This was clearly a tactic that it wasn't a surprise to them that they were going to be throwing hundreds, if not the 1,100 that they ended up storing there for a while. So just to give an example of how bad the conditions were, there's actually a guy who was caught at the Eaton Center with a... He had a bag on him, and the security said, hey, what's in your bag? We're going to search it. He said no. They called in the cops. They searched him. He had a big bag of money. He had actually just stolen some money from a bank or something, he said. I was talking to him in our cage. And he said, the cops actually asked me, do you want to like be thrown in jail, or do you want to go with those protesters in that other place? And you really don't want to go there. And so the cops were using it as disincentive or incentive to try and get cooperation from criminals that whole weekend, I'm sure. That for some example. And our charges, all the people who were arrested here, our charges were dropped because of the illegal nature of the raid. They didn't have a warrant. So after a couple of court appearances, all of our charges were dropped. And, the kind of lingering problems we see with the police and having cops on our campus continued shortly after that. The Toronto Association of Police and Private Security had planned their meeting I should just back up quickly. There is a private security, as part of the campus closure, students were kicked out of their residences used to house security. One of these private security guards from Riley Security had called the hotline saying that there's a bunch of people coming off black clad people coming off the buses from Montreal. I was there, I saw people coming off, people were in their pajamas already, they're sleeping on the bus. Some of them happened to be black, wearing black, some not. And so this lie ended up in all the surveillance and everything happening here. So part of that association is this private security, like Riley. And so this organization called TAPS planned to have their G20 debrief just over here behind this building in faculty council. So that slap in the face was something that none of us could stand. And as I said at the beginning, those organizations that had come together around the campus closure and the G20 meetings met again and invited our friends to come, and we ended up being able to force them not to meet behind this building and on our campus, and we got them off our campus. So and we continue to organize, and we're going to hear more about that in the second panel, so I'll leave it at that, and thanks for listening.
So I'm here, so my name is Jessica Vanier. I'm here as an organizer of the Community Solidarity Network. We've heard a lot about things that have happened during the G20, so I'm gonna backtrack a little bit for people, but I'm mostly going to talk about after the G20. So in the lead up to the G8 and G20, the Toronto Community Mobilization Network, which was a network of different organizations working in different struggles in the city, had united against the G20 austerity to march together. So the TCMN didn't actually organize anything, but it facilitated and provided support for all these groups to get together, because it wasn't just the weekend, it was a full week of marches and other events every day. So it did so in the face of infiltration similarly, and in some cases with some organizers more extremely. There is a really good article right now that was picked up from Briar Patch that's been picked up on the CBC talking about the level of infiltration, which went on for, years, that kind of thing. So TCMN organized in the face of repression, with organizers being picked up by, like, snatch squads and vans, house raids, beatings. Many organizers within the TCMN, but also elsewhere, were charged with conspiracy charges as a result, which is essentially thought crime. This is a charge that's been used in the US and the UK against organizers. And I also want to say, as you said earlier, that it's important not to exceptionalize what happened in the G20. It may be a different level of criminalization of dissent than we're used to against organizers, but police violence and G20 tactics happen in the city every day in poor and racialized communities, whether it be brutality, whether it be ID checks of TAVIS, the Toronto Anti-Violence Intervention Strategy, whether it be house raids. These things happen all the time. So the Community Solidarity Network essentially took the Toronto Community Mobilization Network, took its, you know, took its listserv, took its networks, took its existing infrastructure to provide support for those who became a target of police repression and state violence as a result of the G20. It supports all those charged and also traumatized by police actions. It's done everything from organizing billets for those coming out of in from out of town for mass court dates, direct support for those facing really harsh bail conditions, other forms of court support, ongoing media work, fundraising, and was involved in setting up the G20 Legal Defense Fund. This repression has just actually solidified bonds between organizations. It's done the opposite of what it was intended to do. In some cases, it's even expanded our networks and links between different communities. We've also worked on the reasons why people were out there in the first place, because it's important not to just focus on the police repression, but also the G20 and its austerity policies. So this has meant things like international support. We had an event for, there had been a call out from organizers in Seoul for their G20 prior to that, because they had experienced a lot of the same things. Everything from a detention center set up in a film studio to a debate about sound cannons. They were having sweeps of migrant workers, those without shelter, happening in their community. So we held an event in support of them. We've been involved in organizing against International Police Brutality Day, or for International Police Brutality Day. We've been involved in local neoliberal, organizing against local neoliberal agendas. That's involved fighting Rob Ford. Recently, that's involved our involvement in the Toronto Stop the Cuts Network, which you'll probably hear more about in the upcoming months. So right now, I can talk about those facing charges. So there was over 1,100 people arrested during the course and post the summit. Of that, about 320-ish had their charges thrown out, dropped, stayed. This is a really large percentage of those who were actually charged. Then there were a lot of diversions and peace bonds. A lot of cases, people didn't actually know their rights, especially on the first mass court date. People took diversions and peace bonds, which are not an admission of guilt, but they just didn't actually know what was going on, because it was, you know, several hundred people all at the court at the same time. There's also 25 guilty pleas so far. There's lots of different reasons why people plead guilty, whether it be financially, legal aid, or if you don't get legal aid, essentially sets people up to plead guilty. Whether it be people pleading for the time and tolls on family and friends, whether it's just because you don't have to go through court for years, it can drag out forever, whether it be just wanting people to get back to their life or organizing in their communities. We can see that as well happening quite recently with Jaggi Singh in the past week. He fortunately did not get any jail time. He got a suspended sentence. But, you know, that a lot of reasons why he would choose to plead guilty were so he could get back to organizing, get back to what he works on every day. So there are 55 people still facing charges. I can talk as well about individual. I'm kind of going to be quite open to questions when we get to that. But other things that we've worked on the Free Byron campaign for Byron Sunday with a group of hackers, essentially, who were working on his campaign. So that's a situation where it's actually brought communities together, groups of people who were not connected in any way. As a result, one of his actual bail conditions, after spending 11 months in jail, has been that he has non-association with people who were members of the Toronto Community Mobilization Network. And that's a clear case of just wanting to keep activists and hackers and nerds apart. Essentially, who is defined as the Community Mobilization Network? You know, like 4,000 people on our listserv, so that's like the number of activists in the city, that's like everyone. well, not ever, very close to everyone. So, you know, there's a lot that's going on. Things that are upcoming right now, Mandy Hiscox and Alex Hundert have just filed to challenge one of their bail conditions, which will then resultantly affect everyone else. This is the no demonstration condition to get clarification. Right now, it's an extremely vague term. It's so expansive that people are just not even sure what they can and cannot do. It has been defined by one of the courts as any public meeting expressing a political or moral opinion. So, yeah, what is that? I don't know. So that, you know, especially since people have such high bail amounts of in excess, in some cases, $100,000, like, you know, that's, you know, you don't want to risk that. So people have essentially been not able to participate in their communities, that, which is unacceptable, especially in the face of, you know, even just like being involved in planning lawful demos. People are not able to do their jobs in cases where they work for a PERG, that sort of thing. We have upcoming, Ryan Rainville has an upcoming court date next Wednesday. One thing that we're definitely going to need ongoing support on is the those facing conspiracy charges. Those co-accused will be having their preliminary starting September, and that will require a lot of infrastructure and support. That will probably go on in excess of, you know, months. And it'll be happening up at 2201 Finch Court every day. And then at the same time, none of those people can talk to each other. So they'll all have to be in separate areas, eating separate areas during lunch, all the kind of little logistical things, even just attending, going to court in separate methods. You know, we're definitely going to be needing ongoing support. We've also need ongoing support in terms of fundraising. Also, similarly, Bernstein is actually going to be having his actual trial in November, so there'll be simultaneous weeks on end of court happening at all times, so that will be an ongoing issue. And also, just to kind of end on this, is like, well, this has involved, you know, criminalization of dissent, criminalization of these organizers and taking them out of their involvement in whatever they happen to particularly work on. You know, these bail conditions, while they may be severe, these kinds of, you know, not getting bail for extended periods of time, these are all just general parts of the criminal legal system as they are. One thing that GG20 has done for a lot of people, whether it be directly on the ground, as you're talking about, or in the court, sitting there waiting, watching people get their date rescheduled for, you know, the umpteenth time, is just exposed, like, what goes on every day to a variety of people who just didn't see that and didn't experience that, didn't have that going on to their friends and families. Well, you know, lots of people have that going on all the time. So it's like not exactly like a positive, but kind of is. So yeah, so when we go into questions, if you have questions about specific things that are still going on, I'm quite open to taking those.
Thanks, Jess.
For Rabble.ca, this is John Bonner. Thank you for listening to John Bonner's audio blog, hosted by Rabble.ca and the Rabble Podcast Network.